Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a bi-weekly show about gardening, agriculture, and local producers meant to encourage, empower, and educate gardeners. We strive to provide diverse voices by interviewing experts and garden enthusiasts. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. In this episode, we talk with John Key of Spruce Top Farms, Linda Gorman on how to take care of your bees in the fall and overwinter them. We hear from Catherine Shakey about the invasive reed canary grass, and Brad Kassar talks about fall soil sampling and some things you can add to your soil right now. Let's get started. So first, I want you to introduce yourself.
Okay, hi, I'm John Key. You're out at my farm here, which we call Spruce Top Farm.
What do you grow on this farm?
Well, we grow quite a variety of things. I do succession planting of quick-growing crops like radishes, turnips, lettuce, arugula, other greens. Then some other major crops we grow. I like to grow, just looking around here, I grow basil, I grow green beans, zucchini, and try to grow some other yellow squash or yellow zucchini as well. Tomatoes, it's mostly pickling cucumbers, sugar snap peas, cabbage, kale, some Romanesco and cauliflower, and then we're kind of going down in amount that I grow here as I talk here, but then we do some potatoes, we do some garlic, we do some onions.
Hops?
Well, we do have hops growing on the side of
that's
our house
the
there, so
stash.
Yeah, that's kind of the personal stash, although I did take some to farmer's market this time last year, and some people bought some fresh hops from me, but yeah, we have a couple of nice hop vines that are about 30 feet long growing up off our house, so yeah, that's the extent of it. I, you know, like to always I didn't mention carrots. This year I did fairly well on beets, the best I've done, so I probably grow more of those in the future. Played around with trying to grow celery. I'm always trying to grow a few new things every year, so I like to grow a variety of things. Oh yeah, those are pak choy that have kind of bolted.
I noticed those hops. When are you going to harvest them? Can they take a freeze? I mean, I've never seen anyone grow them outdoors.
They don't like freezes much at all. They have a little bit of protection, I think, just because they're under the overhang of the roof of my house, so that's kind of saved them to this point. But yeah, that's the biggest problem with hops outdoors, is they need this much time to kind of form their cone and form a product that'll actually work. But it's time to harvest them tomorrow.
So for this episode, we're talking kind of about the end of the season. What are some of the things that you have harvested this week?
This week I've harvested plenty of carrots, lots of lettuce mix, some radishes, some salad turnips, a little bit of green garlic, zucchini, even a few cucumbers still. Might be the last time I do that. Definitely be the last time I do that, probably. Oh, I guess some other greens, arugula and a spicy greens mustard mix. I think that's about it.
As far as what you have growing outside, what do you still have in the ground?
There's still lettuce in the ground. Basically everything I just mentioned. There's still lettuce and other greens. There's some green garlic. There's carrots, cabbage, Romanesco, and a few cauliflower. There's a few Brussels sprouts, kale, and radishes and turnips. I'm not sure if I mentioned those.
So your farm is out here on the North Fork. So I assume it's a lot colder than, say, people that live on the Homer Bench.
I would say that's fair in general. I think we're about 450 elevation, so not as high as Diamond Ridge or somewhere, but we've definitely had a handful of frosts already this year. Had one yesterday morning, in fact.
What are some plants that you would want to harvest before a frost or before a hard frost?
Definitely we do sugar snap peas, so there's something that doesn't like frost. That's the first one I would think of. Other things outdoors. Potatoes I usually will harvest, you know, after they'll get their first frost. A frost can definitely nip potatoes if they're not covered well enough. That might be one you'd want to catch just in front of it if you don't have them covered, but generally I'll kind of get them as soon as they get hit the first time.
On the farm that I live on, we wait until the potatoes fall down. Is that a good marker?
Yeah, I would say so. That's not one of my main crops, so I'm not an expert on potato farming, but yeah, that's kind of what I would say. Definitely as soon as you see the plants in bad shape, then there's no point in having the potatoes in the ground anymore.
So I know that kale, you can leave kale out all winter sometime. There's people that have done that before and harvested it throughout winter. Are there any other plants that you know of that are super hardy like that?
I do like a shooting broccoli variety that does fine too, and you can do that with it. Leave it out. If you want to move things into the high tunnel, then you can definitely get creative and you could be harvesting spinach and arugula and things like that, as long as you can keep them going. Yeah, I guess that'd be the main ones I would think of. Carrots, as long as you could dig them out of the ground, but they're going to freeze into the ground at some point.
Have you heard of anybody that has overwintered carrots in the ground?
I've definitely read about it. I guess I could say I've experimented with it, I haven't harvested every single carrot before. And at least on my farm, it seems like it's just too wet and break up and things freeze-thaw cycles kind of keep me from probably successfully doing that. But I read that's a successful way to do it if you have a raised bed or something like that. I want to say I've heard of a farmer doing that around here, but I would hate to be quoted directly on that for sure. You know, things like mulch, if you wanted to try to mulch them, I mean, it'd probably be worth trialing, and I would guess that there's people that have tried it. I feel like maybe I've heard of it being done, but I can't remember who.
Do you know of people that use Rime to extend their season outdoors?
I have experimented with that a bit this year. Not really experimented with it because I know it worked. I did plant a fair amount of late season radishes, bok choy, which I guess I didn't mention earlier. I've also got a little bit of that in the ground, and lettuce and turnips. And I guess my carrot beds too, I went ahead and covered when I was getting frost here a couple weeks ago, consistently for several nights. I went ahead and brought my Rime out and covered that. It certainly works. I mean, I'm a believer in row cover, so yeah, it'll certainly give you a few degrees of leeway, especially with light frosts. It's not a bad idea. We had several nights of frost and then it warmed back up, so had you let everything freeze in the ground back then you might have been done, especially on radishes or something. Now I've gotten two or three more weeks of growth out of those, so it's definitely something that makes sense. I also used it here in the high tunnel, put it over the zucchinis especially, just to keep them going a couple more weeks. So it's, you know, a little bit of work to pull it out and throw it over them, but a lot of people use it in the spring, and so it makes sense to go ahead and use it now too, in my opinion.
Are there any other tricks or tips that you have for extending the season?
About the only other thing I would try at times is I'll use low tunnels or caterpillar tunnels, they're called sometimes, but that's basically just conduit that's bent and put plastic over that. So I did do some late season green garlic in that, and that's just a miniature little greenhouse. And I also have that here in the high tunnel. This is basil here that we're setting next to. Back when it was still going, I tried to extend the season as long as possible by giving that an extra layer of plastic. But those are about the only two techniques.
I'm looking around your high tunnel and I can see that this basil over here is done. I'm wondering if you have a certain method of taking care of your beds after the harvest is over.
Yeah. I've kind of cleaned out my second high tunnel back there of tomatoes and cucumbers that the plants were dead on. I harvested everything that was left and cleaned them out. Kind of this time of year, I'm not always the best. Late season, sometimes things stay till spring, but I do have kind of an active compost pile going. So right now I'm trying to clean things up as good as possible and just get all the plant matter onto the compost pile. It's just less work in the spring.
Do you just throw everything into your compost pile, or is there a method of how you layer or organize the different substrates?
I had built a pretty nice pile here like a month ago. I had gotten some sawdust, some fish waste were the main ingredients. It does seem that it's a little light on nitrogen, so any green plants that go in there, I feel like are gonna help it finish a little bit. So I'm, you know, still learning, love to get a lot better on compost, but not super scientific on it, but it just is kind of obvious to me that it needs more nitrogen. So any green plants I can get in there are gonna help with that, because it's such a carbon heavy mix at this point with the sawdust I put in there. So I kind of just watch it, turn it, feel if it's heating up. At some point here I might feel like it's too late in the year, and then I'll just kind of stash the plants and put it in next year's pile. But kind of just watching it and trying to get it to break down as much as possible, and make sure it's heating up and staying hot.
This is something that I really want to know, because we got our soil tested recently and we have nitrogen, super nitrogen soil in our compost and with everything that we add. And I'm like, well, how do I get the P's and the K's? That's maybe maybe that's a whole nother episode.
We'll yeah, have to ask Brad. Right. I've had soil tested too. I mean, my go-to fertilizer, the main thing I always have used a lot of is fish bone meal, which rather than just straight fish meal, which is super high in nitrogen, the bone meal gives you a lot of that phosphorus. I also use some other green sand and like K-Mag, I think they call it, to give you the K-Mag gives you potassium, you know, organic. But yeah, I'm not the expert on all that stuff. I just try to give it a nice balanced mix, and then I'll follow whatever suggestions I get when I get soil tests done. Probably go about doing it, but I did not look into getting any this year. But yeah, perhaps, probably should.
So before we started talking about compost, I did have a question I wanted to ask you. You had mentioned the tomatoes, you harvested your tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
So I'm told that there's certain visual cues for maybe tomatoes or other plants that it's time for you to harvest them. Is there anything that you would look for?
all I really do is I grow a cherry tomato, and most of the time during the year, I'm just letting them ripen on the vine for the most part and harvesting them when they're ripe or very near ripe. And then at the end of the year, I'm just trying to get them off, trying to get as many out of there as I can before they freeze. Because if they freeze, they're not any good, really, or not for very long. Then I do grow... I have basically just been growing Cherokee Purples, which are a large heirloom tomato. I will say I got lots to learn still on growing tomatoes. A lot of times I've been letting them go kind of until ripe, but you end up with quite a bit of loss, tomatoes splitting, things like that. So I just, you know, reading recently, a lot of farmers will recommend you just harvest as soon as you see a little bit of blush and just let them ripen off the vine. So I may try that a little bit more in the future, or at least not let them get fully ripe just because I see a lot of loss. But then once again, into the year, you know, just don't wait too long. Just get them out of there. They'll mostly ripen, or you can eat them green if you need to, but... You know, we're eating tomatoes clear till Thanksgiving or early December just by letting them slowly ripen on the windowsill or in a box or however your favorite way of ripening them is. So, yeah, I'm not totally sure if that answers your question. Somebody there may be more better clues to look at than that.
It's like, do you just go in one day and you're like, today is the day that I need to harvest? Because I can tell these plants aren't doing so well, or I look at the weather, I know that there's a frost coming in the future. What maybe dictates when the harvest, or maybe it's just I have time today to do this?
Yeah, I mean, of course, yeah, I think it's kind of just on feel. Generally, you'll get, as soon as you get a frost outdoors, the high tunnel will generally handle few degrees of frost without damaging plants, so you know you're getting close when you see frost outdoors, so you got to start watching them quickly. And yeah, the plants will start to suffer, not look so great before the actual fruit totally goes bad. So I guess, yeah, I definitely, especially this year, it became obvious the plants were done, and so it was time to just wipe the fruit out, but the fruit was still in fine shape.
I know some people that grow fruit, like maybe raspberries or something, or grapes. A lot of times they'll wait until after a frost because fruit will become more sugary. Are there any plants that you know that you would want to wait till after a frost to harvest?
I mean, from what I know around here, of course, like wild high bush cranberries and things, but kale is definitely well known for that. It's, you know, our kale is pretty good all summer, but I think down south, from what I've, you know, read and experienced to a certain extent, you don't even want to touch kale until it's gone through a frost. It's just bitter and nasty. Here we have such sweet soils and cool days that we can eat it year round, but it definitely will get sweeter. I think carrots get sweeter, so it's definitely a thing. I haven't heard of anybody trying that on things like tomatoes or anything like that though.
So I know you from the farmer's market, but you weren't selling at the farmer's market this year.
No, this year I, you know, used the extreme circumstances as an opportunity to try something different. So I did set up a CSA this year, and that's where I sold most of my produce, was through the CSA. And then we also, my wife has a hair salon in town, so we did sell a few things that was excess just at a farm stand out of there. So that was pretty good for taking care of all we had this year and went pretty well. I think we'll continue doing that. We might end up back at the farmer's market at some point, but pretty happy with the way things went and kind of like to maybe explore the farm stand in town a little bit more as well.
How big is this farm?
Oh, I think I'm roughly like 5,000 square feet or so at this point. Way less than
maybe like a quarter of an acre?
40,000 square feet or something crazy. So
an eighth of an acre.
So, yeah, really, it's not. But I mean, that's kind of just like actual bed space that I'm giving you there. It might be more like, I've added it up recently, but I forget, 6,000 or 7,000 maybe at the most. I don't know. I may expand. I got lots of land if I want to, but I also seem to be overwhelmed with what I have. So
you and your wife are the only workers?
This year we were anyway. My daughter helps a little bit. Especially she's great at bagging lettuce and things like that. I have had farm workers in the past, but this year seemed like just a good year to kind of keep it in-house. So yeah, it's something we have to decide. I've kind of got some land cleared and ready to go if that's what we decide to do. I did get another high tunnel from my neighbor who didn't want it anymore, so I'm at least going to put that up and we'll see what happens with that. I wouldn't mind, you know, experimenting with more fruits and berries and things like that too, so I don't know. I might do some of that, or if we don't think we need to grow the vegetable farm all that much more. But I'll do a little bit of growing of that as well, I'm sure, in the future, slowly but surely.
So I do have one more thing I wanted to ask. If people wanted to get in touch with you, is there a way that they could, like, as far as maybe they want to purchase from your CSA or want to know about where, I don't know if you're still continuing to sell.
Next week's just the last week for my CSA, so we're basically wrapping up for this year. I had set up a website, which, geez, been so long since I dealt with it, but the easiest way is, we also, when we were selling in town, was we set up a Facebook page. So if you find our Facebook page and like that, then you could contact me through there or and get my website through there.
Remind us the name of your farm?
Spruce Top Farm.
So is there anything else that you wanted to say?
Just the thanks for coming out, and I think it's great you guys are doing this show.
And that was John Key of Spruce Top Farm, recorded on September 29th, 2020. Up next, Brad Kassar of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District talks about fall soil sampling.
So fall time is a great time to get a soil test so that you're nice and prepared and know what to do with your garden in the spring. There are a few things that are nice to apply in the fall, such as lime or bulky organic matter, but most fertilizers and anything that's nutritious that you're adding to your soil, you will lose a bit of that over the winter. Particularly anything with nitrogen easily moves with groundwater. So definitely not applying any fish meal or fish products, as you will lose a lot of that over the winter. But by taking a soil test in the fall, you're able to prepare yourself and get the amendments that you need at the appropriate time in the spring, so that you're not trying to dig through frozen soil in the spring and wait for 3 weeks to get your results back, and by then you have already wanted to plant. So we recommend coming in to Homer Soil and Water and getting a soil test in the fall and getting yourself prepared for the springtime planting. some bulky organic matter sources like peat or alder duff, leaf mulch. These sorts of things supply good organic matter for your soil. And the earlier you put it in your soil, for example, in the fall, it has more time to break down and become available for your plants to eat it in the springtime and throughout the summer. So applying these sorts of amendments in the fall can be a benefit, along with lime, which takes several months sometimes to break down. Applying it in the fall means that you will certainly have all of its benefits available for you in the spring and throughout the summer. Kelp is another one that you can apply in the fall. It has some nitrogen that you may lose over the winter, but it takes a long time to break down. So applying it in the fall will make it more available for your plants. And kelp provides lots of micronutrients along with potassium and some nitrogen, and also does a great job increasing the water holding capacity of your soils, or your soil's ability to hold on to water and maintain water in the soil during dry periods. Although at the end of a long season, everybody's rather exhausted, but getting yourself a little bit more prepared for the springtime when the frantic restarts, soil testing is a great thing to do in the fall so that you can come into the season prepared and ready to plant and amend your soil.
And that was Brad Kassar of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. Coming up next, we hear from Catherine Shakey and Nicole Arevalo, also from Homer Soil and Water Conservation District.
Hello, listeners. This is Nicole from Homer Soil and Water, and today we're talking with Catherine Shakey from Homer Soil and Water. She's our invasive weeds manager, and Catherine would like to talk to us a little bit about reed canary grass. Right now is a great time to identify reed canary grass and spot it out in the wild or in your neighborhood because it stands out from amongst all the other grasses that are out there. So, Catherine, can you please tell the listeners what is reed canary grass?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Nicole. So reed canary grass is a non-native invasive plant that was originally introduced as a forage crop and to control erosion along roadsides. It's a pretty nutritious grass, and it is very good at controlling erosion, so much so that it has spread across the Kenai Peninsula and across Alaska. It's a very established invasive plant, and just as a reminder, invasive species are defined as non-native organisms that cause ecological or economic harm or harm to human health. And so reed canary grass is basically a cautionary tale about what happens when we don't practice early detection and rapid response of harmful invasive plants.
How would we identify reed canary grass out there?
Well, like you mentioned, Nicole, now's a great time of year because it does stay greener much longer than any of the native grasses. It can look a little similar to Calamagrostis or to beech rye, but this time of year it's going to be bright green while those other grasses start to fade. And it has a very tall seed head. In general, the grass can reach 6 to 7 feet high. Around Homer, it's usually between 4 to 6 feet tall. And the seed head is between 4 to 6 inches in height. It's a nice tight seed head, whereas the Calamagrostis kind of opens up a little bit and feathers and fans out. Also, the reed canary grass is a broad-leaved grass. The only other broad-leaved grass we have on the Kenai Peninsula is the beech rye or the beech grass. But that grass, the leaves stay close to the ground. They don't climb up the stem. The reed canary grass has broad leaves that stick out at about 45-degree angles up and down the stem. One of the things that makes it so aggressive and successful as an invasive plant is that it keeps photosynthesizing longer in the season than our other native grasses.
And is this anywhere, or is this mostly in specific places?
Well, the thing that is giving the reed canary grass a competitive edge is that it can grow in all soil types. So you'll see it growing along the road. Homer is very infested. It stretches down East End Road for about out to the McNeil Canyon area. It can grow in partially submerged soil, so along stream banks that are maybe seasonally wet. And it can also grow fully submerged, right in the middle of streams.
So why is reed canary grass a problem?
Well, it's a problem because not only does it outcompete native plants that are critical for moose, bears, small mammals, and fish, but it also changes the hydrology of the landscape. So it will fill in wetlands entirely if it's left to be unchecked and unmanaged. And the way it does that is by shooting out underground rhizomes or roots that can grow 9 feet in one season. And it creates a solid mat of roots versus, you know, the native plants leave space for baby fish, baby salmon to swim in little pockets of water, little air pockets come in. There's more diversity in wetland. But when reed canary grass comes in, it can create a monoculture and a solid mat of roots. It will also fill in shallow streams. And so we have seen this in a few places on the Kenai just in the last 5 years. Bishop Creek up near Nikiski has its wall-to-wall reed canary grass in some places. And that's a concern because if our small streams get filled in, that is eliminating salmon habitat.
Wow. I know that we recently posted on the Caribou Lake Trails Report Facebook page. It is quite a problem, this reed canary grass. So what can be done about it?
So one of the things that I do is coordinate a partnership for the whole Kenai Peninsula. It's called the CWMA, or the Cooperative Weed Management Area. And we've established a strategic plan for the whole peninsula looking at a watershed scale. So because this plant is well established in urban areas, we want to protect some of those more remote areas, like the Caribou Hills, Caribou Lake area. We recently surveyed out there a few of the trails and we didn't find any, which is great, but we need everybody's help if you see this grass in remote areas, especially near wetlands or near salmon streams. We want to know about it, because if it gets reported, then we can actually go out there and do something about it and eradicate it before it becomes a problem. If you've got reed canary grass on your own property and you're interested in learning about how to manage that infestation, you can contact me and we can kind of walk through the specifics of what that might be. We are using herbicide in very specific locations, only where we think we can eradicate populations, because we think that that is the responsible thing to do to preserve salmon habitat. However, we don't promote the use of herbicide in areas where you're going to be managing this plant for the long term. If your neighbors have the infestation, then, you know, it's going to be hard to get rid of it.
And by we, you're talking about Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, but also the listening audience for KVBI stretches all the way up to Kasiloff and across the inlet. And so Homer Soil and Water is a partner in the Kenai Peninsula Cooperative Weed Management Area. So folks that are outside of the Homer District can reach out to other CWMA partners as well.
Yeah, definitely. So the Watershed Forum in Soldotna is a great partner and helps us out a lot with reed canary grass work. Your local soil and water districts, Cooperative Extension Service are all good folks to contact.
And how do people go about reporting it?
Depends on how you like to report these things. Like I mentioned, it is pretty well established in urban areas, and we know that. So if you see it in remote areas, we would like to know. You can call the Invasive Species Hotline, which is 1-877-INVASIVE. That's 1-877-486-2748. That goes to Fish and Game, and then will eventually trickle back to the local contact. And then there's also something called the Alaska Weeds ID app that you can download. If you just Google it online, it should come up. That's great. It is a little field guide for you, so it will help you identify plants. And also you can take a GPS point of the location of where you suspect the plant to be, and that goes to Cooperative Extension Service. And if it's in this area, we'll filter back down to me and we can go check it out. And you can also just contact your local soil and water district or your local Cooperative Extension Service.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with everybody out here in the listening area.
Yeah, thank you, Nicole.
That was Nicole Arevalo and Catherine Shakey of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. Coming up next, we talk to Linda Gorman of Homer Girls Honey. about overwintering honeybees.
You just want me to start out by...
Yeah, would you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Linda Gorman. I'm the owner of Homer Girls Honey. I've been keeping bees in Homer since 2006. I have become a teacher, a mentor. I also started Homer Area Beekeepers Association Honeybee Club. I'm an advocate of honeybees. I like talking about them, so I'm thrilled to be here today to talk about wintering your hives.
When should a beekeeper start to prepare for winter?
You need to think about wintering your hives in August. And the first thing is my hive big enough? Are you 3 to 4 supers deep at that time? Have a laying queen and hopefully no mites. And if that's the case, then once you pull your honey, hopefully by the end of August, you can start feeding your bees a 2-to-1 sugar water feed. A lot of people think it's best to leave honey for them when it actually is not. Sugar water is not as hard on their gut, and they seem to do much better with it in Alaska temperatures for winter.
What are some considerations that people might want to make? What would make them choose to overwinter their hive or to give it up or to abandon it?
The biggest thing is if the hive does not have a laying queen, you're pretty much doomed. The hive's doomed. So that's best then at that point to either give the hive away, and I'll get into that in a few minutes, or you're going to have to kill the hive. And for a beekeeper, that is the most heartbreaking thing you can do, is kill the bees that you've worked with all summer. So I'm a huge advocate of wintering your bees.
People that do kill their hives, do they just take a vacuum in their shop vac?
Yep, put an inch of water in it with a little bit of soap, go down, systematically start. It's amazing. Sometimes they don't fight you at all. They just go. To me, it's devastating to do this, and I have been wintering bees since I started. I think I've only had 2 winters where I didn't do it, and it was because I was queenless. It's unrealistic for a beekeeper to think about starting to feed their bees towards the end of September. Our temperatures are dropping down to the point that the bees will not be able to process into honey and seal it up prior to winter. Therefore, you have nectar sitting in your hive, which is, again, adding moisture to the hive. And that's a problem for our bees. I typically tell people to get your bees down to 2 deep supers and feed the heck out of them. You need 80 pounds of feed, 80 to 100 pounds of feed in your hive to get them through our long winters. Another option you have is to make a candy board. And there's all kinds of directions out on the internet about how to do that and put that on top of your hive under the inner cover. And then put your inner cover on and your top cover. There's a lot of controversy with beekeepers right now over whether to have a vent at the top or not. I've always vented my hives, and that's just a less than a 1/4-inch shim that just allows air to move through the hive. On the bottom of the hive, your entrance reducer, the hole should be pointing up. That allows the bees to drag the dead bees out in the wintertime, and then that doesn't, your hive door doesn't get clogged up with dead bees, and that also helps your airflow through that hive.
I've heard of some local beekeepers using another style of hive specifically to aid in overwintering. Can you tell me about that?
One thing that we do have going on here in Homer, there's a polystyrofoam hive that's come out. We have some longtime beekeepers here that have used that product with high success. I myself have just recently switched to it, so I'm still not out on it. I don't know if I am liking it or not. The BeeMax hive is completely different than wood. It's a polystyrofoam hive. It's hard. The R factor on that is R6, which provides a lot of insulation for the bees. I'm going to try something a little different this year and actually wrap that hive in with something additional, because mine sit outside up against a building and they're unprotected from the wind. So I'm going to give that a try this year. But if you're in woodenware, which is probably 90% of the beekeepers here, the next thing you need to do is go get some 2-inch insulation and cut it to fit your hive perfectly. Cut a door in the front so that they can get out if they need to come out and do a cleansing flight. Insulating that hive in October is huge. You can use straps. You can use big, long 4-inch nails to secure your boards together. And that works. The other thing that I've done over many years is I buy geotextile fabric. That's road fabric or garden fabric. You guys all, it's that black fabric. And in November, I wrap my hive up. And I put a hole up in the top to allow vent air to go through the hive. And that just is an extra layer of protection from the wind that we get here in Homer. Wind and rain are not the bees' friends in winter. You can move your hive to a more suitable location later on in the winter. There's ways to do this without injuring or killing your queen, and get them in a more protected area, because the more protection the bees have, the better chance they have of getting through winter.
What are some of the main causes of the bees dying during winter?
Starvation. This is a big one. Or if they had a mite load and you didn't know it, that will also take that hive out. But generally it is starvation. So that's why we have 80 to 100 pounds of feed in that hive before the middle of October. Once we get into October, they'll actually quit eating. And I feed my bees until they decide they don't want any more food. And then I remove the feeders. They will quit eating when they're ready.
Can you talk about the bee giveaway program?
I started a program here a couple of years ago called the Bee Giveaway Program. And the first year we gave away 8 hives, which means that another beekeeper who has a weakened hive can come and get your hive, which is perhaps queenless, most generally queenless, and they'll combine it with their weak hive, thus giving them a stronger hive to get through winter. Once you get that hive combined, then you reduce that hive down to 2 deeps. Just keep pushing them down. They may be living on top of the inner cover or up on, under the cover, but they will figure it out. They will move down. And they will be nice and snug and warm for winter. Outdoor wintering, honestly, has a 50 to 70% success rate, depending on how you do it. We do have some indoor storage here, and hopefully we're going to have more coming up in the future. They go into a Connex that's air-controlled, heat-controlled, and they're in there for 7 months, and then you go get your hive out, and typically your hive is 98% success coming out of winter. The bee giveaway program gives you the opportunity not to have to go through that pain of killing your hive. And I personally really advocate either doing that or trying to winter your hive. It's always worth a try.
If you do the bee giveaway program, you want to make sure there's a queen for one. Not necessarily.
It depends. If you just don't want to keep your hive through winter and you've got a queen, sure, there's tons of people that will take that hive. That hive's valuable to them with the laying queen. So all you do is just transfer the bees into your supers, your deeps, and you have a hive. But typically the bees that I place are queenless hives.
And then you can just harvest all that honey yourself. You don't need to provide them with any of...
Nope. You give it away. The beekeeper that takes it's responsible for feeding them up for winter. And we all kind of know this, and it's been a good success. Up north in the valley, they've been doing this program for several years with great success. So I started to do it down here thinking that it would help the beekeepers out, and I think it's been successful. A lot of people build shelters for their bees. I've seen some really cool shelters around Homer. They sometimes are protected all the way around, sometimes just over the back and the front. Windbreaks are huge if you keep your hives outside. set up a wind block. If you can't move your hive, put a wind block up for them. And that's just simple. Anything you can find around your yard, piece of plywood, whatever, just get it up in front of the entrance, and it really helps protect that hive. The other thing is, if we get snow, like we used to get back like in 2010, the insulation from that snow is great for a hive. I've had years where I've had to snowshoe into my hives right over the top of them and dig them out, and those bees lived because they had that extra layer of insulation from snow.
I took a beekeeping class with you, and you had mentioned a tip for when it does snow, what you want to do around the beehive.
What really helps is bees are attracted to white. As most beekeepers know, we wear white suits, and you work your hive in the spring or fall, you're covered with bees. But in the wintertime, they'll dive headbomb into that snow and, of course, die. So I just gather up ash from my fireplace or all the neighbors, and I ash my yard, especially out in front of that beehive, particularly if it gets snow in April. Just put some ash out there, and it'll keep them from diving into the snow and dying. And I go out about 20 feet from my hive with the ash.
Was there anything else that you wanted to say?
I mean, I could go on forever.
So I do have one more question. I've overwintered hives and I've lost them, I think, because of too much moisture in the hive. You mentioned putting a hole or leaving places where they can enter and exit. What are some other tips?
One thing you can do, and I've seen this done here successfully, is take one of your deep boxes or supers, put straw in it, and put it up on top of your hive. And that straw will wick the moisture up away from your hive. The other thing I've done in the past is I've put burlap on the inner cover, and that helps wick up that moisture too. But the airflow through that hive is what should keep that moisture level down. I'm always trying different things, reading different things. Anytime I talk to a beekeeper, especially someone who's done this longer than I have, I learn something, and anytime I open a hive, I learn a lesson from the honeybees.
So going forward into winter, what is the kind of lowest temperature that you would want to even open a hive?
You can't open it under 40 degrees. So you need to get them all buttoned up before it starts dropping. Once you get that hive fed up, don't go in that hive looking around. Just leave them alone. You've done all you can do. Don't open it in the winter and try to feed them. You can, if you think they're going to starve in March, put some loose sugar up on top of the inner cover. But again, you're opening that hive and exposing it to cold weather. So it's best just to leave them alone and hope that you did what you need to do to get them there, get them through winter. Oh, one more thing, though. If your bees do come out in the spring and you have a weak hive, you can buy another package of bees and split that up. Without the queen, you just add some bees into that hive. That'll get that hive going, hopefully, so it's a successful hive through summer.
How do you store your extra bee boxes during the winter so that critters don't get into them?
After you've pulled your honey and you have your honey supers to store, oftentimes we'll put them back up on the hive and let with a queen excluder under the box and have them clean that out. If you're in an area where you don't have a lot of bees, although we do have wasps, you can just set them out and let them free clean those boxes up. And once those are cleaned up, you can store them outside or inside, whichever you prefer. But if you go outside, you want to make sure that you secure those boxes so mice cannot get in them, because they will ruin the frames. I personally would put a solid board underneath them, a solid board or one of your tops on them, and make sure there's no way that mice can get in any place in the hive, like any holes you have for vents, cover those up. You can use duct tape. You can just seal them up with duct tape, because the primary concern is keeping out mice. In the south, they have to worry about moss. We don't have that problem. We just have mice. So keep the mice out. I myself keep mine on an inside storage because then I have no fear of mice getting in my hives at all.
So earlier you mentioned the bee giveaway program. How could the audience get in touch with you or the local beekeeping group?
My email address is alaskaqueenbee@gmail.com. HABA, Homer Area Beekeepers Association, has a Facebook page. You can always reach out to us there. There's five of us that started this group, and we are all pretty knowledgeable people about beekeeping and can answer most any question, and we're always happy to help a beekeeper out. We were hoping to start up our meetings again this fall, but that might not be a possibility, so I'm looking at Zoom to do meetings, and those will be advertised in the Homer News and through the Homer Chamber of Commerce.
Okay, I think that's good. Okay.
That was Linda Gorman of Homer Girls Honey, recorded on September 25th, 2020. Up next, Nicole Arevalo has your weekly roundup of current events and opportunities in local ag.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of agriculture-related opportunities and other fun tidbits. Sunday, October 16th, the Homer Garden Club meets at 2 p.m. This month's guest speaker will be Ellen Vandevies from Palmer, speaking about composting via Zoom, open to the public. You can visit her website at ellenvandevies.com. That's ellenvandevisse.com to learn more about the organic, sustainable gardening classes, workshops, and resources she offers. Check the Homer Garden Club website or Facebook page for details on joining the meeting. If you are new to Zoom and would like a tutorial on how to join Zoom meetings, let me know. Homer Soil and Water is happy to offer a tutorial before the meeting. Just email Nicole@homerswcd.org. That's N-I-C-O-L-E at Homer, H-O-M-E-R, S-W-C-D.org, and we'll get you set up. The University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension has a few upcoming online workshops to know about, held via Zoom. Canning Meats and Poultry, October 1st. Mushrooms, October 7th. And a Making Fresh Sausage Workshop, October 8th. Registration and detailed information for each class can be found on the Cooperative Extension website at www.uaf.edu/ces. Scroll to the bottom of the homepage for details. Buying local food. Harvests are still coming in and available for locals to purchase. Here are some options to get local foods before the freeze. Bob Durr's RD Farm Stand will be open through October across the street from the Homer Farmers Market. Open Wednesdays and Saturdays, 12 to 6. The Homer Farmers Market had their last official day last weekend, but some farmers will continue to sell there on Saturdays through October. Swing on by. The Alaska Food Hub has extended their season through December, so check it out. Visit www.alaskafoodhub.org. Jack Luff Bay Oyster Company is open for curbside pickup, 12 to 6, Friday and Saturday. They're also on the Food Hub. They'll also be selling these really cool shucking towels for shucking your oysters that read Slurp Alaska in their online shop. I've seen them. They're very fun. Save You More's produce department has local fresh veggies. Check out their selection and contact Synergy Gardens for their October at-farm sales on weekdays. You can find their online store on the web. And lastly, Monday, October 5th is the deadline to submit nominations for the 2020 Alaska Food Hero of the Year Award, presented by the Alaska Food Policy Council. This award is intended to honor an individual who has made a substantial impact on Alaska's food system. These are people who are champions of local agriculture, subsistence, traditional local foods, and policy to keep these vital things strong. The award will be presented at the Alaska Food Policy Council Food Festival and Conference on November 6th. Visit the Alaska Food Policy Council's website for details.
And that's it for this episode. I want to thank John Key of Spruce Top Farm for talking to us about fall gardening. Brad Kassar of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District for reminding us to get our soil sampled. Catherine Shakey and Nicole Arevalo of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, who talked to us about reed canary grass. And finally, Linda Gorman of Homer Girls Honey. I would also like to thank Carly Konomak and Kevin Cope for providing our theme and interstitial music, as well as Kevin Cope and Ryan Black for our outro music. Thanks, as always, to Homer Soil and Water Conservation District for contributing content to this episode. Questions, comments, and criticisms can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. This show first aired October 3rd, 2020. I want to remind you, tomorrow is the last day to register to vote in the state of Alaska. So do it now. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to vote. And of course, always support your local farmer.